working there for 2 years.
And then when we received word that our oldest brother had been killed in France, then I decided that what I really wanted to do was to serve in the medical corps, one of the armed forces. And I had talked my sister into leaving her job on the East Coast and come and live with me on the West Coast, which she had done. This is the sister older than I am, next in line, and Emily. And she still lives there. She went to work at Boeing then, and she's still working for Boeing today. And but we were going to do it together, and then she backed out. And there was another girl who worked in the factory that went down. She and I went down, and we were going to join the Marines, but the office wasn't open, and we were going to join the Waves, and they weren't open. So then we went to the Army recruiting office, and they were, and that's how I happened to get into that, into the Army. And I went in April of 44. And I asked them, if one joins the Army, do they get to their selection of site and type of work? And they said yes, those, because I had seen that. And yes, they said that they, you do. So I said I wanted to be in the medical corps, and I wanted to serve any place west of the Mississippi. I took my basic at Iowa, and I never got west of the Mississippi. I was trained for the medical corps and never had a chance to work in it, but very briefly.
So what did they have you doing?
Well, first of all, they gave us a very intensive type of medical training. And in fact, the training that we got would have given us college credit if we were going on in the field of medicine. And from there, we went to Florida, and we were based at Miami Beach in one of those $100-a-day hotels. And they took, my first assignment was working in a lab, and I was working with one of the foreign displaced person, and she told me that she would teach me as much as I wanted to learn. If I was interested in staying there, which I was. And I was there for just about a week, and a doctor who worked with research on animals asked if I wanted to work there. He said, come in and watch us for a few days and see how you like it. Well, then I became totally entranced with that, and I said, this is what I want to do. And so I was moved into that section. And I was there for just a couple of weeks. And by that time, I'd come really totally immersed in and excited about the whole thing. And there, out of over 100 girls, there were 12 girls that they pulled out of their jobs and put them into office work. And I was one of those 12, and I rebelled really thoroughly to this colonel as much as you dare to in the Army. And I said, why? What I said, I've told them, when I went into the Army, I said, the office work was the last thing I wanted, and east of the Mississippi was the last thing I wanted. And here I am, stuck on Miami Beach and in an office. And he said that he had looked at our aptitude test, and he said mine worked out just like a fan. And he said, and he felt that I would be happy in it once I settled down. And
what
I said,
mean by a
Yeah, that I could have done, that they had girls who scored very high in mechanical areas. So the aptitude indicated that I could do anything that they assigned me to, I could do satisfactorily. In fact, that fan indicated a wide range of interests. And I said, well, why didn't you choose someone who showed a high aptitude in office work then? And he didn't have any answer for that, but I didn't get out of it either. And so they put another girl that we had been transferred to the Army Air Force by this time. And they chose another girl and that I was very close to. She was she remained one of my closest friends all of the time I was in the Army. She was one of the 12 too. And we were assigned to this office directly across the beach. We could look out our window and see the beach and the waters. And our job was to bring the payroll up to date of the soldiers who were being sent there for a 45-day rehabilitation period before discharge. And some of these boys had been, you know, prisoners of war, wounded, and all of them had payrolls that were messed up in one degree and another, and we had to see that they were straightened out before they were discharged. And there was another GI, this gal and myself, and an officer. And we had a Jeep at our disposal, and we had a lot of freedom. And we had a chance to race around to the six hotels where these GIs were, and some of them were patients, you know, some of them were ambulatory, so it got to be kind of a neat thing, you know, because you weren't doing the same thing every day, and I really kind of enjoyed that freedom. You know, the officer that was assigned to us, even though they changed two or three times while I was there, they were always, you know, lax and easy to get along with. And this doctor asked me if at any time after I'm gone, if there's a chance that he can get me back there, did I want to come back? I said, yes, I would. I really would. And about 9 months later, I had gotten really into the routine of this, bringing your bathing suit, going on the beach during lunch hour, taking coffee breaks when any wanted, as long as you got your job done, you know, they gave you all of the freedom you wanted. And I got this call, it was a doctor asking me if I wanted to come back. And I said, I thought about it, and I said, no. I was interested in going into medicine then. I had really thought strongly about being a doctor. But I guess I made my decision then, because life was too easy. And I was having my little vacation. I was taking full advantage of it. Then from that station, we went to Greensboro, and that was supposed to be an overseas assignment. We were given our physicals, and the war came to an end. And then we were assigned to Long Island, and that was another office job, and I was really anxious to get out. And so I only served 19 months and just couldn't wait to leave, because when I got out, it was in October of 46, and you know, the war was over. In fact, we were in Miami when the war came to an end with the Japanese. So from there on in, you just couldn't wait to get out.
Well, October 46, that's over a year then after the war is over, isn't it?
But see, I went to Greensboro from there, Greensboro, North Carolina.
Oh,
then from Greensboro to Long Island. And that was the hard part of the war, of the service, was after Miami, because, you know, the war was over with, and you just couldn't wait until you could get up.
Did you feel more restrictions on you? I mean, did you feel like your freedom was more limited to when you were on Long Island?
No, it was just that the war was over. You said, gosh, what am I doing here? The war is over. I want to be back in civilian life. If the war had gone on, you know, you felt like you were really contributing. But once the war was over, you just... Well, I didn't make that much of a soldier anyway. I managed to make corporal, and I wonder how I did that, because all of these, you know, like dress restrictions. They used to say, oh, she does a wonderful job, but she's a bit too unconventional. I was always being caught for not being in proper dress and that type of thing. And I never made more than corporal.
Did you go up and down and get promoted anything?
I challenged a couple of times, but I escaped that too. But I did a lot of extra duty type thing. Wash windows because your hair is over your collar. Wash windows because you weren't wearing your necktie today. Peel potatoes because you said something you weren't supposed to. A soldier doesn't do that. That type of thing.
So how do you feel about the Army now?
It's that standard answer you give. You're glad you did it, but you wouldn't want to do it again, you know. I can see if you were at war and your country really needed you, you'd do it again. But it's an experience that you're glad you had, but you're glad it's over with, too.
What are your feelings about people that don't want to get into the Army now, especially, say, in the last 10 years?
Well, you have to give me a more specific situation than that. Vietnam, a Vietnam situation, I'm very sympathetic with anybody who doesn't, you know. It all depends on what the cause is about. But as far as... loyalty to our country, yeah, but blind patriotism, you know, you want to think through the reasons why. And one thing that I do feel very strongly about whenever I hear it is, you know, about giving your son to your country. You know, you can't give anybody's life away. You know, they're giving up their life. You aren't making any kind of a gift in that sense.
What did you have to do?
Well, that was the point of major decision, because I had reached that age where I would have to decide where I was going from there. And I knew that I wanted to go to school. And since a child, I had read and dreamed about going to Alaska. And I knew that if I didn't do it now, I probably wouldn't do it. So when I started thinking about going on to school, I checked into colleges, universities in Alaska, and found out that they did indeed have one. And but I also thought in terms of traveling. So I made my big plan, and my big plan was to go to the first year to go to the University of Alaska, and I got, you know, all of the literature and enrolled and all. The next year I wanted to go to the University of Hawaii, and the third year to the University of New Zealand, and the fourth year to the University of Mexico. And then I was going to decide where I was going to go from there. But I got the catalogs and, you know, the plans and all. And I came to the university in September of 47, and I'm still in Alaska.
What were you studying?
That I had an uncle who I talked to at some length, because I had given up medicine then. I decided, you know, it was the GI Bill, of course, that was going to carry me through for part of my education, and about half of it. And I knew that working in at that time to become a doctor was probably more than I could handle. So I discounted that, and I thought of business administration. And when my uncle heard that, he said, "I would never be happy doing that." I said, "Well, what's wrong with making a lot of money?" And he said, "You'll just never be happy. I know you won't." And so we did a lot of talking, and I did a lot of thinking, and I decided he was right, and decided on education. But I had secondary education on my mind. And when I and started out in secondary education. And then, of course, I switched after I married and had small children. Then I switched over to elementary.
Well, now, before I got married, there's often the feeling that I think women 20 or 30 years ago probably had more than they do right now, that their choices in their lives were either to have a career or to have a family. Did you feel like you faced that kind of a choice?
Not really. As a matter of fact, I didn't really think of it. Probably the only time that it even occurred to me was the influence that an aunt on the East Coast had on me. And she had come to America. She was my father's sister, and she had become a very wealthy woman, and it was through just her own industry. And she, after I got out of the service and I visited my relatives on the East Coast, I also visited with her, and she tried to talk me into going into business with her. She said, "Let's start a restaurant first." She said, I said, "I don't have any interest in it, and I don't have any money to do it." And she said, "I have the money, and I know we can make a success of it." And she spent some time trying to talk me into it. And so in these conversations, I asked her, you know, how was it with her life, and how had she wasn't that well educated, and still, you know, she was independent. And I asked her, how was she able to do it all? And she said, "Well, there's only one reason why I am what I am today." She said, "I couldn't stand to have a husband who could work harder than I could." So she was motivated by that source. And I every once in a while, I did think about, I've thought about her every now and then. And a woman can do what she wants to do, I think, if she really wants to do it. But see, then I can easily say that, because the men who have an influence on my life would have given me the right to do that. I've never been put into a position where a man who is an influence in my life wouldn't have given me that right.
So you've never felt any kind of discrimination against you as a woman?
No. I can see it in the world around me, but the things that I have wanted, I haven't been in that position. In education, I can see it very easily all around me. I can see if I would have wanted to have been in administration, in education, I would have been blocked simply because I was a woman. Maybe, but I see, I don't know that because I never, administration and education is not my thing. In fact, I would give up that position if I ever had, if I had to leave the classroom, I would give up education. If I had a choice, if I had to choose between administration and classroom teaching, I would give up. Or if I had to take an administrative job where it would be administration only, or get out of education, I would get out of education. Because classroom teaching is where I feel I belong.
When did you first have that feeling?
When I first taught. Yeah, I can't say I had no idea about this when I was taking my college training. But once I became an active teacher, from that moment on, I knew that it was in the classroom where I wanted to be, and actually a one-room classroom is where I wanted to be. So I'm one of those few lucky people who's had, you know, their dream come true, the major part of their professional life, because a classroom, a one-room class is where my heart is, and that's where I've been, you know, for most of my years.
Did you meet Chuck before you finished school, or?
No, I met him at the University of Alaska the first year. That's why I happened to be here, and that's why I didn't go to the University of Hawaii for my second.
Was it because you had met him?
Uh-huh. We met the first year we were here. And it was strange because he was born and raised 60 miles from where I was born and raised, and our high schools were high school rivals. Still, we didn't meet until we came to the University of Alaska.
Were you in the same class?
No. Well, it, you know, the school, the university up there was so small that people who had class breaks, even though they were going to different classes, would stand pretty much in the same place, you know. But I've taken college courses with him, but I didn't that first semester, no.
You met him just right as soon as you got there, first semester?
I don't remember exactly when I met Chuck. I don't remember our first meeting.
What was your first impression?
Well, I can't honestly recall either our first meeting or the first social contact that I had with him.
Did he, why do you think it was that he stood out from other people?
Well, he is quite an individual. And, of course, as soon as you get to know him, then it's I mean, it's too self-evident, Kurt. I mean, you know Chuck.
I know.
Don't know Chuck.
But, you know, isn't that strange that I don't actually remember our first meeting? I don't. That's strange, isn't it?
Well, except it may be that...
I think it probably was in one of those between the class meetings, you know. It
you
was.
See somebody, and I know that it happens to me that I come up to somebody and someone is going to introduce me to them. And I say, oh, well, you know, I've seen you around so much, but I just don't know your name.
Uh-huh. And I'm sure that that probably was the situation with him. I saw him a lot on campus and didn't really get a chance to talk to him that much.
Were and you working in a cafeteria or something?
No.
In the dorm?
No. I didn't work the first year. I decided that I would not work the first year I went to school. But Chuck did.
Yeah. It just seems that that was part mm-hmm. of the first meeting that he might. So.
But what was his presence on campus, or what, you know, he sort of categorized people, you know, like there's somebody that's interested in sports, and here's somebody that's interested in book learning a lot, and here's somebody, you know, like, how would you characterize him as, what was he like when you first got
I think for a fact, probably the outstanding immediate appeal was Chuck just is an articulate intellect. And I think that probably impressed me more than anything. You know, he's good looking, but not that good looking. But yeah, I would say his articulateness and his intellect for sure.
Other people sort of think the same thing about him.
Well, they must.
Do you think the fact that you have been raised in the same area, that was an important bond?
No, I don't think it was at all.
Just coincidence.
Yeah, just from the fact that I had traveled sufficiently up until the time that I came up here. I was 22 when I came up here. I don't think the background had anything to do with it. It came as a surprise that he was from there. It would, if he had said that he was from California, it wouldn't have made that much difference.
You know, what I find interesting was that your plan was to go to University of Hawaii the next year, and then you didn't because of Chuck. Now he wants to get you to Hawaii.
I know, and I had enough of an influence that another friend of mine did go over there, a fellow who was attending the university then, a very good friend of mine who, of course, we were all in the same dorm then. She talked and tried to convince me into going into Hawaii, and I just didn't, you know. So here I had convinced one fellow to go. My girlfriend was trying to convince me to go. Chuck had absolutely no interest in going, and I think that would have been one of the most beautiful times to go to Hawaii because everything was still, you know, so still Hawaii, you know. That would have been 1948. It was rather ironic then, because the first trip that we made to Hawaii, you know, Chuck was so enthralled with it, right from the moment he stepped off the plane. And I know that Hawaii came up many times, and he absolutely had no interest in it.
What were some of the things that you and Chuck would do together when you first met?
Well, it was really a neat time to go to the university, for one thing, because the enrollment was so small, and Fairbanks was so small, and you really still had that feeling that you were part of a pioneer culture type thing, you know. And everybody seemed to know everybody, and you were you knew everybody from the university president, you know, to the girl who lived in the next room in the dorm, you know, just on a first name speaking basis. It was also a very fortunate time to go to school, because the students who went there, most of them were ex-GIs. They were going to school under the GI Bill of Rights. The average age level was older, and they were more mature, and you had a challenging type of intellect among the students in the classroom. I can remember one of the professors at one time stating, telling us that he was going to be glad when the GI Bill ran out and he'd be getting his high school students back in.
Because
his job would be easier. And it was that they would question, and they wouldn't just accept answers just because they came from, you know, the authority in front of the classroom. I think more so the need to know was much more acute. Maybe it's different now.
Were you a part of that group of people that did that?
Yeah.
Well,
for one thing, to come out of the army and then to be plopped into a dorm where you are regulated by hours was, to say the least, aggravating.
You were not regulated that
Yes. Time. You know, to say you must be in the dorms by 10 o'clock, you know, that type of thing. And but that was the smallest of the worries, you know. It was things also in the classroom. I was, I wanted to major in English, and I had enough run-ins with the gal who was the English professor that I finally just ended up giving it up. And it wasn't that we felt our questions were so unreasonable, it just felt like you weren't getting the answers that you thought you should. You know, if you had themes that were rated less than you thought they deserved and you wanted to know answers why, you felt that you had the right to know, you know, and you would question, and they it's just easier for them to say that you're ready to accept what they give you. And we always weren't.
What did the University of Alaska look like then?
Oh, it was so incredibly different. You need to look at pictures to believe it. You know, many of the dorms were just wooden structures like army barracks. Our dorm, the Hess Hall, did you ever see Hess Hall before? Yes, you did, before it was torn down. It was that gray three-floor dormitory or building used as the women's dorm.
Whereabouts was that?
Almost directly across from the Eielson building. Almost across the street and from where the museum is, the building where the museum is.
Across the street. Was it?
Going where they had a big parking lot? Well, yeah. It was the building, not in the other direction.
Oh, going north. The place where they built Greeny
Hall? Yeah. Anyway, it was just this plain gray building. And it was very bare, and the reason it was bare was because Dean Duckring had taken, when he saw the initial drawings, he took off all of the fancy facade, and with the money he saved from that, he was able to add a third story to the building. And that was the most permanent-looking structure on campus. The library was the second floor of the museum. The museum was the gym. And then, of course,
the gym was the gym. That's why it looks like a basketball court in here.
Uh-huh. And but most of the buildings were wooden buildings. They looked like gray mental institutions, type buildings, you know. But you have to see a picture of it to appreciate it.
So, did the students study a lot? Or what did the students do?
Yes, also, your communication between, or your transportation between Fairbanks and the college was a bus that would take care of you if you didn't have your own car, and there were very few cars in those days on campus. It wasn't at all like you see it now. And I can remember just going into town mainly on weekends, unless there was some special activity, you know, like a basketball game at the high school or something. But your social life was probably rotated much around the activity in the dorms. And then, of course, you had some campus activities.
Were most of the people who attended the university from outside of Alaska? You said they were GIs.
Yes. In fact, the first full-blooded Eskimo graduated from the university in 1950. Mm-hmm. He was a classmate of ours, Nagazrik, Arthur Nagazrik from Nome.
That was that fairly strange to have a Native Alaskan in class then?
Well, he was the first full-blooded, but they did have Alaskan natives up there, but they were in the minority.
How about the people that had grown up in Alaska?
I don't know what the ratio was there, Kurt. You know, I know there were several of them from different parts of Alaska, including some faculty members. But I would say, still say that the larger percentage was from outside then, because the enrollment was so small. The enrollment dropped to less than 100 when one of the semesters I was up there.
Total enrollment for you?
Mm-hmm. It's a couple of hundred when I first arrived there.
That is small. I didn't realize it was that small. Did that cause more problems, having a very small enrollment?
Well, it had its advantages. You were much more intimate with the whole structure. You know, to me, that was an advantage. Probably that's from my background of living in a small community situation. And by the time I got to Alaska, I certainly preferred it. You know? That's one of the reasons why I came up here, too. I think it was also a disadvantage in you, from your lack of not enough faculty. That's one of the reasons why I didn't graduate or get my bachelor's. I got my master's there, but I didn't get my bachelor's because by then we were married and we decided if we were going to stay in education, we needed to get away from the university because your education department consisted of one professor. And one of them, that particular one, wasn't adequate as far as we were concerned. And we really didn't feel like we were getting the proper training for the profession. And that's why we decided to finish at Chico State.
Well, before you left for Chico State, what was your feelings about Alaska, say outside of the university, but Alaska as a place to live, you know, Alaska as a place that you had dreamed about and thought about as a young girl wanting to go to?
Well, Hawaii, New Zealand, Mexico, and all of the other places had faded. I could see that my future was in Alaska. I knew that my future also was in education. And I also had to work by then besides going to school. And I had some periods where I had worked a full-time job plus going to school. And so I had it, and it was with the telegraph system, Alaska Communication System in Fairbanks. And so I got to know the town quite well from the business that telegrams and businessmen in town involve. So I got to know Fairbanks quite well, and I really liked Fairbanks in those days.